This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Ramon is present. And Jonathan, what a week. Well, no, nothing really happened.
Well, what a week. I mean, maybe it's been a week for you as our listener.
Yeah, who knows? By this time next week, when this releases, maybe the whole of South Africa will be a new province of China. Who knows what's happening?
We're already a new province of China. We just haven't realized it yet.
As long as I have a number in the Chinese slave camp and I'm the one at the top, I'll be happy.
So as long as you're the leader in the gulag.
Absolutely. The stitch.
Got you. Well, we've of course got the official opposition to the Communist Party of China in studio today. and the official, one of the MPs in the official opposition in South Africa. Perhaps a future leader of the party. Who knows? Some people might hope it turns out that way. None other than Gwen and Gwenya. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me here.
So, welcome back to the studio.
It's been a long time.
It's been a while, yeah.
I was your first guest, actually, wasn't I?
You were our second or third, I believe. Yeah. You were still working for Bloomberg at the time.
Thanks for popping the bubble. I don't
know. The pleasure's all mine. So let's have a quick recap. You were in Bloomberg when we first met you. You went to become the COO of the Institute of Race Relations, and now you're head of policy and a DA MP within the Democratic Alliance. So what's easier, solving the Middle East crisis or doing policy for the DA?
Well, I'm pretty sure it's probably the latter, objectively, not that I've ever tried to solve the Middle East crisis, but no, politics is difficult, but perhaps not quite that difficult.
All right. Well, I mean, this is what the podcast is about. We're going to see how difficult it is. So Jonathan and I, we are what you would call your base, I suspect, even though I'm an anarchist and I don't vote, but I...
Yes, so I'm technically not the base then.
Indeed. Well, Jonathan is.
Okay. I am literally the base.
Jonathan is. So we have been highly critical of the DA recently. Fairly, if I may say so myself. I think we've been rather fair. what is happening? There's two fundamental issues here. The policies on the table, as described on the website, which are firm, binary, and good, and just the way they're communicated is just the opposite. Awful, equivocal, and vague. What's happening in the DA?
Well, in general, I'd like to think that our policies, I mean, shouldn't be binary. They should be quite nuanced. And I think a lot of the time in most policy areas, you know, there isn't necessarily a silver bullet for how to resolve a particular issue. And so the conversation should most of the time operate not in a gray area in the sense that it's opaque or it's vague what needs to be done, but in the sense that it should be relatively complex enough and not reduced to such a level of simplicity that your message is borders on being too binary and being too populist. So nuanced in that sense. But where we have perhaps deviated from policy on paper, I mean, I'd like to perhaps get a bit more information on that. Is there any particular one area where you feel that the DA has been unclear for you?
Right.
And perhaps I can explain it in a more specific case opposed to in general terms.
Certainly. So there's one clear example. So Ronaldo Host is a DA councillor in Nelson Mandela Bay. He said on Twitter, and I know this is based largely on Twitter, because yes, that's the milieu we work in.
No, that's fine.
So Ronaldo Ho says, DA is unequivocally against EWC, and we will oppose it at any cost, basically. A colleague of yours, Pumzile van Dam, says, that's not necessarily true. We believe in the Constitution, and the Constitution does allow for expropriation without compensation. Okay, that may be true as well. I've read Jackie Dugard's work on that, and she says, you can expropriate, and the compensation can be zero, depending on the context. That's fine, but the DA is against expropriation without compensation because Musi said so in Parliament when the motion was passed, and the policy on your website says they're against, that you are against expropriation without compensation. And then you have an MP saying something similar, but not saying we are against it overtly. So there's mixed signals there.
Well, maybe if I can just take a step back a bit to talk about how the general issue has been communicated. Now, expropriation without compensation is an interesting issue because you almost have two groups that you might ideally want to communicate to. So you have your beneficiaries, so the people that might stand to gain something should, you know, expropriation without compensation, for argument's sake, be passed. And then you have those, on the other hand, who'd be affected by it. So those whose land would effectively then, or property, be expropriated. And so in crafting a message, you can either talk to those who stand to be the potential beneficiaries and say to them, actually, this policy is not going to benefit you, and here are the reasons why. Or you can speak to those who stand to be affected and, you know, craft a message that speaks to them about why their property should not be expropriated without compensation. Now, of course, ideally, you want to speak to both groups. I mean, it shouldn't be an either or. But the nature of the media cycle or the nature of communications is that most of the time you can have a policy area where you have 20 things that you want to say in that policy. But the reality is only one key punch message goes through. You know, almost every policy area, each party is going to have a one-liner that almost explains what their position is on that particular issue, as nuanced as it may be. And going back to then those two camps, I think the DA's message has tended to speak a little bit more to those who might stand to be the beneficiaries and try to explain to them why actually expropriation without compensation will not benefit them. So in so doing, I think the message has tended to be about the custodianship issue, to say that actually expropriation without compensation in terms of the ANC and EFF view will mean that effectively the state ends up being the owner of the land and you'll just be almost perpetual tenants of the state. And I think the DA spent a lot of time trying to drive home that message about title deeds versus the state owning the land and the fact that private individuals wouldn't actually be owners. But the consequence then of being so focused on that message is that you haven't actually communicated strongly enough, okay, regardless of who owns the land, how do you plan on getting it in the first place? Are you going to expropriate it without compensation, or are you going to expropriate it with compensation? And I think we admittedly perhaps do need to be a lot stronger now in driving home that other message. I think people get the custodianship issue now, or at least I hope they do. The fact that on the one hand, you have people saying the state should own the land and citizens should be tenants. And on the other hand, people saying, no, actually, there should be private or individual ownership of land. I think we spent a lot of time communicating that message, and I'd like to hope the DA's position on that area around private ownership is clear. But perhaps where the message is less clear is around how do you actually plan on getting the land in the first place. And I think it should be then quite clear that we are strongly against expropriation without compensation. But here's where I think you could reconcile what, and not reconcile for the sake of reconciling, to be diplomatic, but I think because they're genuinely reconcilable, those two positions, that expressed by Ronaldo and that expressed by Pumzile, in the sense that, yes, you can take the principled and perhaps also policy position that you're against expropriation without compensation. So there are many policy reasons why it would be a bad idea, including destabilizing the banking system, because so much property actually is actually technically owned by the banks and not by the individuals themselves, etc. So, and those arguments don't necessarily have to do with the Constitution. They're almost practical or economic arguments against expropriation without compensation. But then there's still this constitutional argument that's still in the balance, because the Constitutional Court, we almost need a court case to rule on this particular, to develop the law around this particular area, around whether there wouldn't be some circumstances in which, according to the criteria laid out in the Constitution, it might be just and equitable to compensate without compensation. I mean, sorry, to expropriate without compensation. And so I think all Pumzile and Mara just been saying is that, well, yes, we, in principle, you're against expropriation without compensation. But because we also are a party that says that we abide by the Constitution, if a court, if the Constitutional Court rules that, you know, expropriation without compensation is permissible in these areas, then we would also accept that. So I don't know if that clears up.
I know what Pumzile was trying to say, and I sort of, understand, as I said, I've read Jackie Dugard's work on this.
Yes.
And Helen Ziller made a case for expropriation without compensation in the Daily Maverick a few months ago. Someone had land that was overrun and he refused to do anything with it, and etc. So she made a case. I don't agree with it, but she made a case, and
saw cases in the city of Johannesburg where you have a derelict building and literally can't find the owner. So who are you supposed to compensate? Yeah.
And those sort of make sense. But as I would think that your base are property owners. And perhaps you haven't focused on property owners saying,
yeah,
we accept your right to own property and we know that it's very valuable to you and we will fight for you. See, against this. I think that, from my side, has been lacking.
Yeah, I would echo that and just go a step further. I think instead of standing on, you know, you've moved from the hill you're willing to die on, which I would hope would be you will not obliterate private property rights, and you're fighting on the hill of let's talk about property rights, let's have discussions where we might be willing to sacrifice them under certain circumstances to try and attract a base which is not your base, because that argument of going to the people who may be the beneficiaries are literally a 6% group of people who can only respond to cogent arguments with give me the land, and so your base is not hearing a message of we will not allow property rights to be trampled under any circumstance. To me, that's the punchy message that should have come through.
No, well, let me first, I think there's a question about the base and I'll get to that secondly. But the first one around protection of private property rights. I mean, I think I disagree. I think we're quite firmly for protecting private property rights. We're not saying that we would outline conditions under which private property rights might be violated. We're just saying that the Constitutional Court may very well do so, because if you want to read into an interpretation of just and equitable that contains scenarios like we just said, where there's a derelict building and you literally can't find the owner, then one might say, well, it seems fair in that instance to then not compensate because you literally aren't able to do so. In those circumstances, I mean, and look, and I'm not a legal scholar here or someone who works in the law as a profession, but I would say that it might be helpful for people then for a different language altogether to exist for those particular scenarios and actually be quite firm that we don't accept expropriation without compensation. Mm. Those instances aren't actually instances of expropriation without compensation proper. There's something else, and you can give it a different legal term.
But the exception doesn't inform the rule.
Exactly. No, but that's where I would completely agree. And I think if we wanted to keep the argument almost clean, you could say, yes, we're firm against expropriation without compensation. These instances where this and this happens, this is actually called this and it's something else. But I feel that perhaps that borders a little bit on legal semantics, whether you would call that something.
Well, the process already.
I mean, it's kind of like with just maybe to give an example, if someone dies, right? Murder is a completely separate category to culpable homicide, etc. Although the end event is the same, someone has been killed, or someone is dead. You know, so I think perhaps in this case as well, expropriation without compensation could have a legal definition that means one thing, and that we are against that particular. You know, expropriation of compensation is not permissible. And then you could have a different legal term that explains those other circumstances where we feel it is permissible. I think we're now getting into really sort of technical legal.
Look, just to say that we've already got embedded in the law a process by which if your land, for example, was stolen, no matter how long ago it was, if you can show any proof of that, then you basically can have your land given back to you, essentially. And we've had many land claims, and there's an entire process that was followed actually by the government. Was it 4,000 claims, Ramon?
1.8 million claims.
Oh, 1.8 million, 4,000 still outstanding. That's I think it was.
Their compensation did not occur.
No, where restitution occurred.
So, yes, but were they compensated?
93% of them were compensated in cash, and the rest were compensated with
the actual
land.
No, I'm talking about
land.
The property owners. You're saying those were examples of.
They were compensated, yes.
They were compensated if their land was taken, but most people didn't take land, they took money. But I mean, that's restitution versus expropriation. I hear what you're saying all about that. I think, you know, one of my objections to the DA recently has been, and I say it again, you know, not dying on that hill. It's and this is an accusation which has been going on for years, that the DA is ANC light. And the reason is because instead of making your own stand, and I'm using that very loosely because it's not an accusation against you, but instead of making, as a party, your own stand, you go and fight in the ANC's arena. You go and fight in the EFF's arena. This was a long-standing criticism of the party that it was merely a reactionary party. The ANC would do something, the DA would react. Then for a very long time, what seemed to happen is there was a change. And in fact, we recently had someone in studio who said that the DA had a policy that they would not just talk. The ANC was Voldemort. They did not say the word ANC for 3 months. And that was part of their communication strategy, because they didn't want to be seen to just be reacting to the ANC. They wanted to be seen to be its own party with its own ideas. And I find often what ends up happening is the ANC says something, the EFF says something, and you then go and play on their football field. Instead of playing on your own football field, let them come to you. And when that happens, additionally, what then goes on is messaging gets very diluted, because instead of, as I said with the EWC thing, but there are other examples, instead of standing on this is where we stand, we're not even engaging in this kind of ridiculous notion, you end up having these debates on nuances of EWC, and it's like, why are you even talking about this?
Well, no, I think that's slightly ridiculous. I think if the DA wasn't saying anything on land reform at a time when, well, Cope, you know, there Cope are all these discussions.
I think COPE is killing you guys. And the reason I think that that's happening is because Masiwa Lekota is not engaging. He's not saying yes, but he's not saying maybe. He's sitting and he's going, you know what? AfriForum, I probably don't agree with all of their politics, but they are against EWC, so am I. Here's me shaking hands with them.
But how is that not engaging? That's absolutely engaging. Sure. You're just saying you find but their stance he's taken, a lot more.
He's taken an absolute position, and I think on something as important as EWC, an absolute position matters, because the thing that will kill this country, in my opinion, there are only two things that are absolutely going to end this country. EWC is one of them and NHR is the other. Those are the two things. If they get pushed through by this government, we're done. You can kick, you can scream, and Musi can become head of premier in the Western Cape. I couldn't care. It's all over. So, and as a voter, that's terrifying. And the fact is that the main opposition is having nuanced discussions with leftist radicals who praise Venezuela, yeah, where people are
but
eating their
the
pets.
That's the problem, you see. Look, I don't think I'm ever going to apologize for taking a nuanced policy stance, because what we can't do is be pushed to extremism equally just because the other side we're engaging with is extreme. So then you just have, you know, two far sides of each, you know, the far side of each side, you know, debating with each other for the sake of clarity. You know, I think, unfortunately, people have to accept that, you know, most issues are complex, they are nuanced, and we have to try and obviously come up with an answer that is, or communicate a solution that is simple enough, but not so simple that it then begins to lose meaning or borders on populism, which I think being absolutist would then do exactly that.
Gwen, Jonathan mentioned the base recently, well, just now, rather. A critical aspect of the DA, and you're being critiqued by people who are like us, and I accept, Jonathan and I accept, we are the upper echelons of your base, in terms of, like, we care about your policies.
You're saying so many things that I want to unpack, as they would say. I mean, firstly, who are people like you, and what are the upper echelons? I didn't realize the base had levels.
I'm going to slightly distance myself there, but
but you care about the policies. Most people don't. Voters don't care about policies. They care about brands. I mean, this is like a universal acknowledgement of democracy. We get that. So we care about policy. We care about the inner working of the DA. We care about your message. Most people don't. We accept that. So a big question mark by people like us and people on the Renegade Report group that consists of 1,000 people, middle class, care about property rights, are that they feel alienated because they believe that you are seeking votes that are not within your base. You take your base for granted. How would you respond to something like that?
I mean, the first thing I want to say is that I think actually far more people than we might like to give credit to actually care about what a particular political party's message or policies are. But it goes back to what I was saying in the beginning, that, you know, you almost only have, you have limited opportunities to grab people. So, yes, not everyone is going to dissect every 20-page document that you have on a particular policy area, and then 20 times another 20, depending on how many different areas you have policy documents for. So yes, very few people are going to go through each of those policy documents line by line and design a spreadsheet as to and tick each point that they agree with, and then at the end tally up if they have more points they agree with than points they disagree with, and say, well, right, I more or less agree or don't agree with the DA. Everyone actually has certain issues for them that speak to them, and upon which they decide to almost be their you know, their make or break issues. And I think that goes the same for you as well. I mean, you'll tell me if I'm misrepresenting you, but I think you might zone in particularly on the DA's message that has to do with what you might call broadly identity politics or identity issues, as well as perhaps property rights. You could perhaps, and I mean, and those are two areas, right? There could be many other areas, foreign policy, immigration, environmental policy. I don't know. Conceivably, there could be many other policy areas where if you actually sat down, you do agree with us. And on the balance, you agree more with the DA than you don't. But because those two are your burning issues, they become do or die issues for you. So, and the DA's position of all, and for that matter, any party's position on just those two issues will be your deciding issues. And I think most voters are probably similar, that there is an issue for them that can become a tiebreak, if you want to call it that, between different political parties and who they vote for, despite the fact they might have a lot more ground of agreement with one party. The disagreement on that one issue might make them choose a party that they actually don't share a lot in common with, but because they're saying the right thing on one or two issues. And I suspect that's what's happening a little bit with, and again, it's a very small sample, it's on Twitter, and perhaps the kind of group that you're talking about that's now a little bit incensed that our message is not strong enough on expropriation conversation is deciding, well, we're not going to vote COPE. I don't think they're saying that because they've sat down, as I said, with a spreadsheet, written down all of COPE's positions on a multitude of policy areas and written down the DA's and tallied and said, actually, we agree more with COPE than the DA. That's not true. They've just been impassioned by one or two issues, and those have become deal breakers for them.
I agree with that, but here's the sort of flip side of that. So before, I could know I would put an X next to the DA, and I could do that because I knew underlying the party were classically liberal values. No matter what happened, I didn't have to read your foreign policy document. I knew that you would stand in a classically liberal way on foreign policy. I didn't have to read your health document. I knew that you stood in that way. And the problem is that has been fine previously, and you're correct that people don't list COPE versus the DA. The problem is when you go off base message, this is who we are. So you're the classically liberal party. You're the liberal party. Maybe the classically liberal people don't like, but you're the liberal party. You've got people, firstly, you've got people in your own party saying things like we're the progressive party, which is you're not. And if you are, that's terrifying as well. But the point is you're the liberal party. So before, when you were the liberal party and you generally did things that were liberal, then you could easily just tick next to the box, because I didn't even need to know. I didn't need to be an issue voter. I just needed to be a principal voter.
Well, this is where I disagree with you. I think it was always issue-based. It's just that when you felt more comfortable about the two issues that you care about, you thought you could extrapolate the rest to also be in agreement. When those two are suddenly no longer the position that you agree with, you also now extrapolate and say, well, the others must also not be ones that I agree with. But I think it's always come down to probably one or two burning issues. And I'm actually not disparaging that. I'm not saying that that's necessarily a problem. If that voters behave that way. I'm just pointing it out that there might still be far more in common between those who consider themselves liberals and staunchly so as and understand the ideology and et cetera, and the history of sort of liberal ideas, the Enlightenment period, whatever, and the progress of liberal parties in South Africa. Those people who are quite attuned with perhaps, let's say, the academic and the, you know, the academic arguments might... You know, those people might feel that at this moment in time that isn't true, but I think it's also because they're probably focusing on one or two issues.
So for me, I mean, that could be true. I think that you shouldn't underestimate the fact that many ANC supporters are deeply communistic in their views and beliefs. They support the National Democratic Revolution. And yes. If the DA will not stand by its liberalism and say, this is who we are liberal above anything else, when the ANC is standing on its National Democratic Revolution roots, the South African version of the Great Leap, and they are happy to stand on it in Parliament, nod along when it's pointed out to them. If the DA is not willing to do that, that's a particular problem. And for me, it's a critical mass issue. So I can... for years, I've put up with certain issues I've had with the DA, for example, being nannies in the Western Cape. I think that when the DA gets into power, they basically want to tell everyone what to do, when to drink, when to eat, etc. And that annoys the hell out of me as a more sort of libertarian-leaning liberal. But But I've put up with stuff like that. But there's a critical mass. You know, there's a suspending someone because they said something good about Israel. There's telling AfriForum we don't agree with a word you said and then doubling down on that from two MPs. There's just too much that adds up together. I think that could be a communication thing rather than an actual party position. Yeah. You would need to tell me more.
Geez, it becomes very difficult to respond to you guys because you say like 10 things in one that I might wish
Sorry,
to respond
Gwen,
to.
But you know what?
You'll remind me perhaps if there's a particular thing that you or area that you want me to address that I'm not touching on. But I still actually haven't made the point about the base.
Go ahead.
And it's fine. I'll make it very quickly. It's not necessarily a long point. But just to say that, you know, throughout the show, one of you have said things like the base are property owners or the base are, you know, that's not how I define it. The base of the DA should be people who abide by liberal values. And then, of course, in the discussion needs to be, well, what are those liberal values that we, you know, that we're all drawn to or that we abide by as liberals? But I think it needs to stem from there. So our base are not white voters. Our base are not middle class people. Our base are not property owners. Our base are people who share the values of liberalism and would like to advance and promote them and think they're the best way to lead a meaningful life and for economic prosperity, etc. But that's really the starting point. And those people who share those liberal values can be rich or poor. They could be, property owners or not property owners. They could be, they could fall across different.
But they all believe in title deeds, for example.
Title deeds is merely a mechanism. They believe in property rights, yes. And for now, probably title deeds is probably the gold standard how to have proof or some kind of measure of showing that this is your property. But title deeds are just a tool, I suppose. But yes. That was just the very quick point I wanted to make about the base, that anyone who shares liberal values, and it shouldn't really be, you know, it's not really much more difficult than that. But then moving on from this, and what are those liberal values?
Yeah.
Now, interestingly enough, I had a conversation with someone who was saying, is there any value anymore in calling ourselves liberals for those who value liberal values? Shouldn't you just stand by the values themselves? Because different people who espouse different values will call themselves liberals. So there's no neutral or independent arbiter that's going to come down from on high and say, this side is right. You guys are actually the true liberals. So potentially you're going to be having a semantic debate about liberalism forever because there is nobody to come down and bang the gavel and say, this is what liberalism is. Nobody's
liberalism.
Going to tell us who are the real liberals. So actually all you can do is say, we stand for these and these values. Fine, you could stand for others and you want to call yourself liberal while you stand for those other values. There's no one to tell us actually which side is right or wrong.
It's a bit postmodernist of a take on liberalism, though, because liberalism does have some sort of founding fathers, so to speak. And it is very obvious what liberalism means. I mean, the simple things, non-aggression principles, for example, or basic ideas around economics.
That's true. You can almost any topic that you would want to look at, there are splits as to what, you know, the view might be. And I actually do this often because in trying to grapple with what a policy position should be, I try and find, of course, I look at what's almost the extreme, those who might call themselves leftists, people on the left or socialists, what their position might be. But often, actually, I'm looking for people who call themselves liberals, but actually fall on different sides of the same issue. So, for example, you'll find even libertarian blogs that are, or people writing in journals or these kind of online, mostly, because those are the most accessible. But for example, an issue like abortion, you'll find libertarians who'll put forward very cogent arguments as to why the libertarian view on abortion is to be pro-life, and on the other side, libertarians who argue that it should be pro-choice. So I don't think that there's as much agreement on the liberal spectrum as we might like to think. So everyone might say, for example, and the problem is that the key tenets are vague enough that everyone will agree to them, but it then differs on the actual policy issue. So, for example, everyone might agree, yes, we believe in individual rights. But now when you come to an actual case, a test case or a case study of that, people will then find different ways of saying, actually, this position better advances individual rights versus another position. So it's like, and I'll go back to the abortion one because it tends to be the most binary for people. Liberals could agree that we liberals advance the rights of the individual and being pro-life. But then people could say, well, whose life? And then I don't know if the choice between whose life is a liberal decision. You then start getting into a scientific or medical debate about when does life begin, or perhaps even a spiritual one if some people do have a particular faith. And so I think a lot of these discussions, they devolve much more than just along liberal liberal lines.
Well, because liberalism in many respects is the ideology which wants as many voices as possible and wants as many ideas debated as possible before it comes down to a final decision on anything. And even then, it's not kind of settled. It's one of the it is argued often that that's the sort of problem with liberalism, is it ends up killing itself, because even when it reaches perfection, as close as you can get to that, because that doesn't exist, it still argues with itself and sometimes overshoots the mark then or cocks it up. But I still think that there are, abortion is a, I agree with you, it's very binary, but it's an easy one to choose to kind of prove your point.
No, I mean, let's choose one that perhaps is less so. Let's say freedom of speech. Or there are people who advance individual rights arguments about why speech should be curtailed in some instances because it clashes with another right. So you could have somebody who might think that there's nothing illiberal about believing in the right to dignity, and therefore if there's some speech that infringes on the right to dignity, the person's right to dignity is far more an innate right than a right for you just to speak gratuitously. And so from a liberal position of believing in the individual right to dignity, I think that trumps the right to speech. And I don't know, again, if there's some kind of liberal encyclopedia or Bible that we can go back to and say, okay, well, from the liberal perspective, does the right to dignity trump the right to speech? Is the right to dignity even a liberal a right that liberals should value? There's nowhere to go that will provide definitive answers to these questions. We can just debate with one another. And I think those debates are fruitful, but what they won't do is tell you at the end of the day who has a better claim to calling themselves a liberal and who doesn't. So perhaps it would be valuable just to say, well, you call yourself a liberal and you believe in the right to dignity and you think the right to dignity trumps free speech and that's why you're choosing not to, you want speech to be curtailed. Well, I also think I'm a liberal, but I actually don't think that the right to dignity trumps the right to speech, and we don't think speech should ever be curtailed. I think in the end, it's going to really come down to that, to just focus not on the label of being a liberal, but rather ask people, well, what do you mean when you say you're liberal? What are your bottom line issues or your core values? And then decide whether you can agree to those, as opposed to fighting over the label about liberal. Because I don't think that fight is going to be very fruitful, and I don't think it has any definitive end either.
I actually agree with you on that, in that respect. So is it easier just to have an issue and fight about an issue in terms of not between liberal or fascist or communist, just an issue in and of itself, property rights, yay or nay, freedom of speech, yay or nay? What are the limits? Obviously, expropriation can happen if you pay compensation. That's the limit of the property right. So those are of maybe a little bit easier to discuss. And my second question is, though, are South Africans, do you think that South Africans could be liberal? Are there enough liberals in South Africa for the DA to actually continue with the liberal message, so to speak? Or do you think it will be determined, as you said before, by one or two topics or hot button issues that individuals have? And that they'll naturally accrue to the DA because you touch upon those issues in the way that they agree with. Not because they're liberal, because just the issue at hand is the one that they agree with.
Well, I think it will definitely be the latter. I mean, and even on the ground, when you go and when you go speak to voters.
And that's good politics lingo. Hey?
Yes, when you go and speak to voters, I mean, I've never found myself in a situation where I'm trying to convince somebody to be a liberal. I mean, I never say, let me bring you over to liberalism, take you under the liberal wing kind of thing. You always do just speak of the issues that people care about and explain what your position on those issues might be. And I think definitely that's the way to go. Look, it's not to say that we must never fight about what being liberal means, because I think it is an important but perhaps sometimes far too abstract and removed conversation. The person who feels persecuted because they don't have the space to articulate or to express themselves, the person whose life circumstances are curtailed, you know, and they aren't able to live a life that's meaningful for them or to earn the fruits of their labor, those kind of things. Those people, I think, don't want to enter, you know, if there was a Maslow hierarchy of needs in a political sense, I don't think people want to enter into a discussion about who's a liberal and who isn't a liberal. I think they're fascinating discussions to have in a, you know, around a table with fellow philosophers and, you know, thinkers as a nice sort of intellectual wank on a Friday evening. But I think if you're in the game of trying to persuade people to allow them to give you their vote, then I think you need to answer what you're going to do in far more practical ways. And who gets to own the label of liberal? Well, that's a slightly different fight. I mean, one that I'm obviously passionate about myself. I get really irked when people that I, in my view, don't share what I would say the right liberal values. But again, to say I'm right, but just the ones that I think should be the values that any liberal shall hold. I also get annoyed when they want to lay claim to calling themselves liberals. But as I say, I don't think there's anyone to actually adjudicate and provide certainty to that particular debate. But just to say, you asked, are South Africans liberal enough? And again, we've just had a whole discussion about, you know, how difficult that is. But I would highlight perhaps three things for me. Look, there are obviously more. I mean, I'm not saying these are the only three values of liberalism. I'm saying these are the three that for me are very important. One is a strong commitment to the individual. And obviously in a society like South Africa, people say, well, but groups are important and groups are group identities. And I raise this in particular because I think it's one of the most oftenly used sort of retorts to the idea of individualism. People say, but groups matter. And of course they matter, but actually it's individual rights that manifest or give rise to belonging to a group. And the healthiest types of groups are groups where you are free to join them. So there's voluntary association where you're free to leave them, importantly, so you can leave those groups. And also ideally, once you're part of that group, as much as possible, everyone can play some kind of a part in determining what that group believes and stands for. So, you know, if you join a club or if you join a political party, it should, for example, be all of those things. So a political organization might be an example of a healthy group. You're free to join, you're free to leave. And when you're in that particular organization, there should be some kind of processes in which you could be involved in framing what that particular organization believes and stands for. So I think that's a healthy group. Those kind of groups should be encouraged. Unhealthy groups are, for example, racial groups, which I don't buy into very much. And they almost violate all of those criteria. Now, of course, these aren't criteria from God. These are Gwen's criteria for healthy groups. So, you know, it's my version of what I think an ideal.
Close to godly.
Yeah, well, it's my version of what I think a liberal group is. One that is free to join, free to leave, and you can inform what it stands for once you are actually part of it. So if we look at a racial group, you're not free to join. People typically assign you to whatever other race. You can't leave. I can't denounce being whatever race that I am. Well, you could try. I mean, what was Rachel?
Rachel Dolezal.
So yes, you can try, but most often people will not allow you to lay claim to a different race.
You can change your sex and people will accept it. You can't change your race, however. I don't know why, but that's
yes.
That's
well, we can talk about the sex one and people will accept it.
We're focusing on the DA, Gwen.
But
don't
yes,
go
anyways,
off.
Anyway, so yes. So for example, race could be not free to join. Not free to leave. And certainly, I don't know of any kind of black forum that happens every month where black people decide what we are offended by and what we believe. Yet almost periodically, the self-appointed champions of racial groups will say, well, either they will apologize on white people's behalf and say, we're sorry. I don't know who they, maybe white mass meetings do happen.
Every Tuesday night, 8 o'clock. You know
I'm not
where.
Aware of any black mass meetings though. But despite that, people still do speak on behalf of entire race groups. So, yes, groups are very important, but I think there need to be groups that abide by the three principles of liberal groups, which e-liberal groups do not abide by.
I all agree with those principles of group. It's consent and being able to change the dynamic and to leave if needed.
Yes.
That's my conception of a state, of an anarchic state. Come in when you want, leave when you want, and while you're there, you can change it as well. So we agree, Gwen.
While we're on this.
I've got a question.
Ah, come on, Ramon.
Okay, fine. Quick question, because you ramble.
We're on the point. We're on identity politics, and because you've just brought us into it.
Yeah.
And there seems to be a group in the DA, certain people who like the identity politics stuff, who seem to identify with it, and then there's a group that doesn't seem to identify with it. The leader, for example, very recently two incidents happened where he bought into the identity politics thing. One was where he sort of threw his wife under the bus and said that she got where she was because she was white. And the other one was where he basically 30 minutes after Ashwin Willemser walks off a set, he says he knows what it's like to be Ashwin Willemser and be treated.
Black person knows what it feels
sure.
like.
Sure. So that's buying into it. So you don't have to talk specifically to Dear Leader, but I would like you to speak about why there seems to be this infatuation by some with identity politics and how we can get past this, everyone, not only the DA, but the country.
Well, the reason there are differences in that, I mean, is because people are different. It's as simple as that. You know, if we, the three of us, decided to start a political party, I'm sure there'd be many issues that we would, you know, go back and forth on as to what our position should be. So I think that happens any time that you have a group. The other question people might want to ask is, okay, fine, we understand that people are different and in any grouping you'll always have differences, but why can't you at the very least communicate one line? Now, that's the part where I would say, yes, I concede. To the extent that people have found a message confusing, we should do far more to ensure that we are communicating the same line, even if we don't all agree on the same line. So, but although that's what most people want, I would just warn that I think that's a dangerous position. So people, as you know, as happening now, complain that there's conflicting messages or that there's signs of disunity. I just want people to understand the reverse, though. That fine, let's say we get our, you know, hypothetically speaking, political parties, including the DA, get their acts together and they start just communicating with one voice. So there'll never be a contradiction. What one person says will be the same as if you speak to anyone else in a different part of the country, etc. That's fine. Well, I don't think it's fine, but I'm just saying that's what would happen if that's how you want to, that's the direction you want to go. The danger, though, is that you then never get to experience the debate. I mean, if we went to a meeting as a political party, as the DA, and then we decided on a line, for example, and again, I'll just go back to abortion, you know, we decide on a pro-life line, you know, you will miss the fact that, yes, at the end of the day, there might now be the official position might be pro-life, but there was a very tense and extensive, nuanced debate on both sides, you know, strong pro-choice supporters. And unfortunately, in the day, it came down to a vote because that's how democracy usually works. And then a decision was made. And then because the public likes unity and consistency, even those who are pro-choice now have to toe the pro life line. So that's what happens. And I think that's also equally dangerous. My ideal would be that we could be a society where people could try and grapple with nuance a little bit better than they currently do, where they could understand that, fine, I go on this party's website or I understand this to be the official line, but this person is saying something else. And there's no problem with that. They're saying something else because they've got a cogent way of reasoning or cogent arguments and by which they arrive to their final conclusion, and it's different from the official party line. But I think it helps knowing that those people exist. And I think actually if some people know that those other people exist, it will make them a little far less despondent, because if you end up just thinking that the DA is entirely pro-life, and for you, the pro-choice issue is important. You say, well, for me, that was my do-or-die issue. I'm now going to vote for a different party that believes in pro-choice. But you miss the fact that actually 40% of the people in the DA are pro-choice. And perhaps if you can accommodate that and say, well, the official line now, because it came down to vote, is pro-life, but there's actually quite a strong grouping of pro-choicers, and I agree with them on other issues, I'm going to stick around because actually there might be an opportunity to reverse that decision and bring in more pro-choices. But so I just think that by demanding consistency and unity, and that the official, that the line that comes out is always consistent, you miss the internal debates that are happening, which I think are informative as to give you a better idea of the detail that goes on within the party and perhaps the future direction that the party might move in. Mm. And well, now when I'm saying party, I suppose I'm talking about any political party, but I think that whether it's the DA or the ANC, people are always demanding unity. And I just want people to understand the cost of the unity that they are asking for is almost submission from those other people who don't share what the majority vote ended up being. And you need to give those people a space to articulate that minority view.
As someone who sets policy in the party, though, don't you think voters want to know, like, you want to govern. The DA wants to be in power, I assume. Don't you think voters want to know where you stand on something? I mean, something more controversial than abortion is your BE policy. So I'm being flippant, but you know, that's a good example. You guys set a thing, then there was clearly disagreement after the fact. And people want to know, if they vote for you, what is your actual policy going to be? Not really, some of you disagree, that makes me feel a bit better. I don't know.
No, but as I said, those two things would then exist, but it depends on the society's capacity and appetite for nuance, as I said. So as I was saying, ideally, there is obviously an official line. You can't have then it being a free-for-all, and it depends on just who you speak to on the day. There has to be an official line, which when asked, what is the DA position or what is the ANC or EFF position on X, everyone should be able to say the exact same thing about what the official line is. But what I'm saying is people then should be able to...
can be individuals.
Yeah, almost take the party hat off and say, this is the official line, but actually there was a lengthy debate and I happen to be of the view of this, but unfortunately at this meeting or party structure there was a vote and this was decided, so our party line is this, but I can tell you that this is what I personally believe. And I would give the space, ideally, I think, people to do that. But the difficulty is that people will say, it's too naive to think you can give people the space to do that, because the media and the public will crucify you. They will say things like, they are confused, they don't understand, why have you said this and the other person that? So unfortunately, because the public refuses, maybe not refuse, but seems incapable to handle nuanced views in a political party in South Africa, it's going to actually push political parties towards being authoritarian-like, and quite dictatorial around their message, as opposed to giving their members freedom to express what they individually believe. And if I look at political parties, particularly like if you look at the UK or the US, people identify, oh, he's part of the more hardcore Republican caucus within the Republican Party. They're a bit more moderates. I mean, you get things like yellow Tories and the Tories. These are the guys who are actually a little bit more like the Lib Dems, but they're in the Tory party. They're a bit more liberal. The yellow Tories, whatever. These are the true blue kind of Tories. Yeah. And I think that ideally is what should happen. You should be able to say this political parties, whether they're socialist or liberal, whatever it is, are still going to have a people on a spectrum. Even a party that is communist, you'll have ones that might be like almost revolution now, let's take over everything, and some who might say, no, it's a process, and yes, the ideal is communism, but we have to go through capitalism and socialism first. So I think even within the left there'll be a spectrum, and there's nothing wrong with knowing, oh, so and so from the ANC, I don't know, Rob Davies or whatever, he's a hardliner, but so and so actually is a lot more liberal, and just to understand that that's the way groupings are. And it actually can become interesting to see how that balance of power, that dynamic flows within political parties from one election to another, time to time. And I think the balance of forces do constantly change slightly.
Last question from me. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. Why, my perception is that it appears that only the DA really struggles with this. I think the media are more critical of you than other political parties, despite you being arguably the less racist one. But the EFF, you read the constitution, if you disagree with Julius, you're out immediately. The ANC, it's a mess. People sort of accept it's a mess. You can have 12,000 hectares. No, you can't have any hectares. It doesn't matter. The media won't grill them as much. They will grill the DA. Is it perhaps a lack of leadership from the DA in showing this is what we actually believe, but we have agreements and disagreements within it. But that's not terribly important because the position is the most important thing. Maybe the position is not articulated as that hill to die on, so to speak, as the binary thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing to say is that I don't know if I could definitively say that the DA does get persecuted more than other political parties. It often feels that way. Although if I take a step back and maybe open the newspapers, there almost constantly is something, a negative story you could find about the ANC. But I think the difference, one of the differences first, that because there are so many things going wrong, there's no laser focus on any one issue. And perhaps if there is at the moment, it might be, let's say, corruption. So everyone is so focused, let's say, on the corruption element of what's wrong with the ANC. There's not much time to talk about, or they don't dedicate much time to talk about anything else that might be wrong with the ANC.
Policy failures, for example.
Policy failures. There's just so much that's wrong, and nothing gets almost the laser-like focus and attention that perhaps it should. So it can. So in that sense, the opposition can then almost seem silenced out, or it can seem very much like it's just all white noise because there's so much of it. Whereas you get a party like the DA, where I think most people agree most things are going right, and that's often why people often say, well, with such a healthy environment and most things going right, why does it keep shooting itself in the foot? But I think it's actually because only those one or two things are going wrong, and when they happen, they are so visible and so clear because there is nothing else. There is no noise in the DA, if you want to call that, of 100 things going wrong. That when only that one or two things go wrong, every single person, every single media outlet is only going to talk about those one or two things because those are the only two things that exist, which gives them a level of detail and laser-like focus that other issues and other political parties won't get.
And proof is in the pudding. This year, or last year, it was Helen Zille's colonialism tweets. This year is Patricia de Lille. Like, those are the big major problems in the DA, it appears. Like, we know exactly what they are. If you want to talk about EFF, it's the shooting in the Vol and speeding, Floyd Shibambo speeding in his Lambo and talking about cutting the throat of whiteness. There's so many things. And the ANC, let's not even get started, will be here all day. I get your point, but I think you're afraid of being disliked. For what you stand for.
You,
not
DA
you, the DA.
Yeah.
The DA. You're afraid of being disliked.
You, I don't think I at all
No. You love being disliked. That's why we like you, Gwen. Because you stand your ground, even though taxation is theft and you disagree. But I think the DA does have a problem with being disliked. And I think it should be, look at itself and say, it's fine to be disliked for what we are. And if you don't like us, don't vote for us. And that's perfectly fine in a democracy.
It's funny because they did stand on that hill for racists, for example. And sometimes they erroneously call people racists, but which is fine. I don't have a problem if someone's truly a racist and the DA goes, we don't want your vote, you're a racist. I'm fine with that. But I think they should be willing to turn around and go, you know, if you believe in X and we definitely stand against X, I've heard all your talk about nuance, but there's certain things we must be against. And we're against that. And if you don't like it, please, we don't want your vote. I think Ramon is correct. There's too much wanting to be liked.
I would. Well, okay. Again, very quickly on those two things. One, on wanting to be liked. I mean, absolutely, a political party at the end of the day wants to be liked. Well, I don't know about if like is the right word, but if like means we want people to prefer us above all the other political parties and therefore give us their vote and the ability to govern, then of course that's almost your singular focus. And that's one of the decisions to be made, right? So you get people talking about fringe parties coming up to try and, you know, persuade or the other side. But then at the end of the day, if you've made a decision that you need, well, that you would like to be in government, you also, you know, then it means that you are then playing the game, if I can call it that, of how to attract votes. But where I agree with you is that you should have bottom line values or principles or positions that you can't, that, you know, even if it means losing an election, you do not fiddle with this, because at the end of the day, if you are not this, then it's not even worth being in government, because then it's not as if you should want to be in government for its own sake. Mm-hmm. You want to be in government because you think a liberal party needs to be in government. If you get into government no longer being a liberal party, then
what's the point?
But I think, as I'm saying, you need to then define what those bottom line issues are, and then be clear about ones that then aren't bottom line issues. What you can't do, though, if you would like to govern, is make every single conceivable issue a bottom line issue. Fracking is a bottom line issue. This is a bottom line issue. And we're not going to budge on anything. No, I don't think that's going to work. You have to be clear about which issues perhaps you can be a lot more flexible on, and perhaps you'll win the argument of the day another time, and which ones there's actually never a time to compromise on them.
Awesome. I want to finish just with one last thing, which is we've grilled you for basically an hour, and unlike almost every other politician who's not willing to be in the studio and be grilled like this, I really appreciate it. And you're willing to take hard questions. So give us two minutes on what you're doing, what your policies are, and what you're kind of envisioning running up to the elections. You can give us a bit of an ad for the DA.
I mean, yes, yes, fine.
Ramon's not so keen on that idea.
2019 elections, no one really cares.
I want to hear what Gwen's doing with regard to policy.
That's fine. Policy doesn't matter. I agree. But Gwen, why shouldn't you be the next DA leader, basically, is my question. And if you don't want to be, who's better than you? And if no one's better than you, why don't you become the new leader?
Jesus, a lot of... Well, firstly, no, I have no immediate interest in being the leader, simply because I think it's far too soon. And unlike maybe some people, I do think there's value in time and experience. And I think there are people who share the values and principles that I do. I would say most, obviously, in the DA, because we are all in the same party. But perhaps one.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Gwen. I don't think it's too early because you haven't been corrupted yet.
There's the principled argument, you know, maybe I have the right principles, but I think there are other people that have the right principles, but also have the time and experience in the party to, you know, perhaps that might be a better fit. So I do think there's something for time and experience. In fact, I was very reluctant even to join politics at all, never mind to think of, you know, being the leader of a political party. I've always been of the view that I have a level of disdain for career politicians. So there's a slight disappointment in myself in going into politics relatively young, because I fear that I will then become what I hate, and that's a career politician. So yes, I think I'd like to give myself a lot more time before entertaining that idea. But let's actually, hypothetically, if I could look into, you know, the future, 10 years time, etc., it would still need many things to change and perhaps some convincing for me to want to be the leader of the DA or any political party, because what comes with it are not typically things that I enjoy. So it doesn't happen so much now, because I think I relatively am quite a D-grade celebrity or famous face, so I don't really get noticed. But once in a while it happens, and to be quite frank, I don't really enjoy it. I don't really like it when I'm, you know, standing at the airport or doing something and someone comes up to me and says, oh, you're that DMP or DA whatever, and, you know, so what do you think about this? And what, you know, it's like, actually I would like moments that are just mine, and I'm not on duty right now, which perhaps is not a politically correct thing to say. Some people might think, well, you're on the taxpayer's dime and you're always on duty. But I think if you're the leader, it's that probably is magnified a million times. So there are certain things that come with that level of profile that I don't think naturally sit comfortably with me. It's not to say that I would never consider it. I just think that certainly for me, there would be a lot to consider from a personal level about whether I'd be willing to do that. And then also the what I feel are kind of disingenuous elements of the job, at least for me, I suppose colloquially known as like kissing babies, etc. But it is the truth that I'm a lot more comfortable in a boardroom type environment, perhaps in studio doing a policy debate or that kind of intellectual discussion. I'm less comfortable, trying to pretend to be I don't know what the word is.
Yeah, fake it, really.
Yeah, you know, and
put
unfortunately,
on a public persona,
a lot of,
amongst the crowd.
Go to a soup kitchen. I mean, I would do a soup kitchen in my own private capacity with no cameras and stuff there. That's one thing.
But you wouldn't put on a duck and stir a whole bowl of.
But I don't want to go to a soup kitchen with cameras and cook for people and then smile and hold the soup. That, to me, those moments are so incredibly cringe that.
So may I
suggest?
So much would have to change in the political environment for me to be a leader. People would have to no longer want those kind of
things. I suggest people are ready for that change and actually they enjoy a genuine person, and I think that they're over the in generation of kissing babies. But
right.
but yeah.
All right. I just like the shade.
Are you
being done?
Are we leaving policy? You don't care about policy, Ramon. So my question's down the drain.
I don't care about policy. I just want to know what is.
Well, I can still answer.
No, we don't care. We got 1 minute. What is the bar for 2019? How do you know if you have failed in 2019? Is it about growing the vote by X percent, or is it about representativity in your vote? What is that measurement of success to know that the previous 5 years weren't wasted?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's if we grow. I mean, if you lose votes, then certainly you haven't succeeded.
But it's not just 1% growth. I suspect you would want 7%. Seven more percent of the votes, or 200,000 more votes, or is there a target?
Well, we'd like to govern. I mean, that's the honest truth. But so you get to.
But it won't happen in 2019.
Well, exactly. So I mean, then it's not about what we would like, but what we at the moment think might be achievable.
And then you evaluate that at the time, basically.
Yes, but I think a very difficult target, but still one that's within the realm of possibility, is to win Gauteng. I think it would be a really big deal for the country if the DA governs Gauteng as well as the Western Cape. I mean, already with governing, well, rather precariously, of course, but governing the key metros and also governing the Western Cape, it does mean that actually the DA governs in areas that generate more than 50% of South Africa's GDP, just slightly over 50%. But certainly, I think if we govern Gauteng entirely and the Western Cape, it would give the DA a lot more leverage, in my view, to start selling itself a lot more as the almost the party for the economy. If you
sounds like a monopoly capital party to me.
Well, if you want economic progress, if you want to vote for growth and for the economy, this is the DA. Yeah. We actually govern the levers of the economy, where the economic hubs are, and we'd like to spread that throughout the country. If you want to vote for a backwater party that doesn't generate growth and prosperity, you can vote for the ANC and the EFF. but I think that message becomes more and more compelling the more the strategic areas in which we govern are. And I think it might then hopefully become a domino effect from there. If the two economic centres are thriving and people can see that, I think they will definitely want that kind of change to eventually come to them.
Move their way. Okay, we need to wrap it up, unfortunately, because we've run out of time.
We have run out of time, and I've got people at home waiting for me to feed them.
Well,
not my family, guests.
Well, you've got a whole bunch of patrons that have come on to the to support us, basically. So we will do that as a separate podcast that will go out to all the patrons on Patreon
on Tuesday, as with the usual podcast live to the public.
So you guys get to ask questions from Gwen, but for the rest of you, the podcast ends here.
It's rather unfortunate. It's felt really, really short. There were so many other areas I would have loved to talk about.
Well, we will happily have you back. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please do let us know. If you listen on iTunes, please leave a review. If you listen on any other platform that allows you to do so, we really would appreciate that. Share the podcast around. I think, you don't often get this long format with anyone, really, and certainly with politicians who are in strategic positions like you are, who are willing to defend their position. It's really great to have that opportunity. So share the podcast around, and I think it does clarify some things in terms of where the DA stands. Ramon?
Well, as always, Gwen, it's always a pleasure to see you and to hear from you. I think you are, you may not realize it, you say you're a D-grade celebrity, etc., but I think you are the sort of the new figurehead of the DA for some people who might be a little bit not
disillusioned.
He might be, but that's the word I'm looking for. He might be a bit disillusioned. So keep doing what you're doing. I hope we make the DA great again. Well, you will. You will make the DA great again. And we just need to make some hats that are blue that says make the DA great again. And I think keep doing what you're doing. You're always welcome on this show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. As always, thank you for listening. You can find us on Twitter @Renegade_Report, on Facebook, the page and the group. As always, you can find Gwen on Twitter @GwenandGwenya, myself, Jonathan @Jonathan_Witt, and Ramon @RomanKavanagh. Catch you next time. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.